welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyond Ananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed the light on the endarkened corridors of power and also shine a light forward to where the evolution is taking us. You know, there's a classic story about a hiker who slips off a mountain trail, and the only way he can break his fall is by grabbing onto a thin branch. So he's hanging there, holding the branch, and he sees it's only a matter of time before the branch is going to break under his weight. He begins to pray for God's help. He begins to pray fervently, and to his surprise, the clouds part and the sky, and he hears an unmistakable voice that says, "Let go." Well, he continues holding the branch, and once again, and louder, the voice says, "Let go." Well, at that point, the hiker turns to the sky and says, "Hey, anybody else up there?" Well, you know, that seems to be our human condition, and possibly our human conditioning, that when faced with the kinds of vexing issues that we face today, where our survival as a species is threatened, yet we continue to do the very same things today that we did yesterday, things that only make the problem worse, hoping that maybe there's somebody else up there. Well, our guest on Wiki Politiki this week, author and integral thinker Terry Patton, calls these kinds of problems wicked predicaments, because like the whack-a-mole, it's hard to address the problems in one place because they keep popping up somewhere else. So even as we're aware of the dying parts of the ocean, the rising seas, the melting ice caps, and all of the other burgeoning crises that seems to be gathering into one perfect storm, we collectively seem paralyzed even as we desperately seek a solution. So I'm happy to have Terry with us today. Terry Patton has been a student, a practitioner, and a teacher of integral philosophy for more than 15 years. He has a new book called The New Republic of the Heart that is a hopeful and yet very sober look at our current New World situation, with an eye and ear toward cutting through all of the BS and getting through the heart to getting actually right to the heart of the matter, which is the matter of the heart. So welcome, Terry.
Thank you so much, Steve. I'm happy to be here.
Okay, well, you know, you described the current situation as a wicked predicament. What do you mean by that, and how would you describe our situation right now?
Well, there's actually a technical definition for a wicked problem in social science.
Yeah.
Multidimensional, with multiple causes and symptoms, can't be definitively delineated or demarcated. The people involved frame it very differently. You could think of it as a symptom of other problems or a cause of other problems, both. It's new, unprecedented, complex, consequential, but solutions are hard or impossible to test accurately. And it has a tendency to fester or get more severe, with nothing automatically stopping the vicious cycle of intensifying it. And it can be super wicked if there's no central authority and if those seeking to solve the problem are also causing it. Current policies are increasingly leading to very negative future implications, and time is running out. And we're facing an ecological predicament particularly, but also we're hitting the wall socially and in a whole variety of ways. We're at a tipping point, and that tipping point is dawning on us, and yet, for the most part, society is in denial of it. So that's our situation. A tipping point, though, is underway. The future will not be like the past or the present. And so we're kind of poised at this point where civilization may be completely disrupted. And I've just mainly mentioned the negative things, but there are actually potential civilization transforming advances, both technological and in terms of culture and spirituality. So there are positive changes potentially in the mix. What we know, though, is it ain't going to be the same, and we're poised right there. And so that's where we are, and actually facing that, actually coming to grips with it, dropping in, being capable of the seriousness of the situation is really a stretch. It's a stretch for the heart. It's a stretch for our emotions. And yet, things are far too serious for us to lose our sense of humor.
In fact, humor is really necessary because of everything is so paradoxical. I mean, first of all, if you're living a life in civilization today, you cannot help but add to the problem. I drove somewhere this morning. You know, all of these things, there's no way to escape it other than to, you know, go to a mountain and become a breatharian. You know, it's basically we're all in this, and who doesn't want things to stay the same in a certain regard if they're comfortable? So it really is vexing in that regard. What was it that sparked you to write this book? How did this book come about?
Well, for, you know, in a way, it's my whole life. You know, I was raised in a leftist cooperative outside Chicago, really mentored by aunts and uncles sort of in that community of about 70 people to be a social activist. And once I got to be a young adult, I realized that if there was going to be a revolution, it better begin with me, that me and my fellow radicals were a little immature and arrogant, and the transformation better begin in our own hearts. So I devoted myself to spiritual growth. I was in an ashram for the next 15 years. And so both outer work and inner work are deep in my DNA. I've always known that we were facing problems that would require a new consciousness. I was trying to awaken in a way that would allow me to be the change in a whole new way. And I've long recognized that we were facing a critical shift, that there was something of an evolutionary emergency that was going to goad us to some kind of new stage of cultural evolution. And also, but separately even from that, you know, my deep involvement with inner psychological and spiritual work showed me that a much more profound integration of all these different kinds of inner work was really important if it was going to become able to enable us to solve these problems that required a new consciousness. And then the other thing that happened that really goaded me to write the book was just a few years ago, we began to see this radical shift in carbon levels, pH in the oceans, actual temperature readings, weather data. They're tracking much worse than the previous worst-case projections. And I saw that this emergency was much more urgent, was really upon us in a much more vivid way now than ever before.
Yeah.
So out of that, I wanted to address it. Yeah.
And we'll talk more about your background in integral philosophy. How did you come up with the title, The New Republic of the Heart? How did that come about?
Well, you know, I realized that I could no longer really locate myself as a middle-class person kind of ensconced in this system, because the system itself is so out of balance with the life support systems that we all depend upon. I had to find my way to locate myself in a different polity, and I began to see, you know, polity is a word that just means political entity, that in some sense I was becoming a citizen of a different alliance. I'm very much an American. I'm in sense, you know, lots of patriotic feelings about our country. On the other hand, you know, with President, you know, since the Trumpocalypse, it's been a mixed thing. You know, I have not been proud of my country, and in a way, I can't really be a comfortable middle-class citizen of Trump's USA. I have to locate myself in a different political entity. And I began to realize, you know, this is coming into being spontaneously. There is a new kind of loyalty, a new kind of patriotism that's arising in people's hearts everywhere. And that this is actually already underway. You know, many, many people doing good work in a variety of ways, inner work, outer work, going around the system, a variety of different approaches, are actually creating something that has never existed before. And, you know, it's structurally inherent. A system that is facing existential challenges is going to begin to mobilize its best capacities, even without thinking, just as a systems dynamic, a conscious biological system will do that. And so I think what's best in human beings is rising up in many people as a desire to be of benefit, a desire to wake up, a desire to break beyond this sort of sleepwalk into apocalypse kind of dynamic that we see the larger society kind of hypnotically entranced in.
You know, there's an interesting physiological study of telomeres, and you know, telomeres are associated with longer life and greater health and so on. And one of the things that makes our telomeres longer, which is a good thing, is service. So there may be something that's intrinsic biologically that when we're connected with other people and when we're looking at the bigger me rather than only the little me, we get to access this. And, you know, you're talking about the new republic of the heart. In the book, you talk about the coherence of the heart. You talk about the work that HeartMath has done. And indeed, the series that I'm doing with the Association for Global New Thought is called Heartland Security. Because really our true security is in the land of the heart, that when we begin to connect with other people, even if we imagine that they believe something different than we do, in this place of being human, where we have not been dehumanized, I would say a vast majority of us can connect and respect one another in that space. And our political discourse, of course, is has devolved into huge polarization that doesn't really benefit. One more. Anything else about the book and the title that you wanted to say?
Well, we are, you know, time has run out. In a way, the whole context of this is this 2x4 across the forehead that we've all run into, which is that the gig is up. You know, and perhaps any intelligent species that could manipulate its environment would eventually succeed so fabulously that it would overpopulate and pollute and begin to, you know, kill off everything else and come into an existential crisis. Maybe this is a necessary moment in our in the evolution of an intelligent life form on any planet. But we are there. That's where we are right now. And what happens in our lifetimes matters tremendously to the future of life on this planet. It matters to our own grandkids. I mean, things couldn't be more serious. And yet, to face that requires an emotional confrontation that most people shy away from. And we've got to come to recognize that the sobriety and seriousness of that situation is not the end point. That there is actually a hope and a joy and a playfulness and a humor on the other side of despair that's a whole lot more robust than the hope on this side of facing that darkness. And with that vision of possibility, we can wake up to a sense that we can go right into the darkness and let it be a kind of fire that grows us into a new level of maturity and leadership. And that's what I'm hoping my readers will begin to experience, because, you know, the book takes them pretty deep. This is a transformational experience reading this book.
It certainly was for me, because, the first part of the book is really reading about you are here, you know, where we are now. And then as you begin to discuss some of the ways that people have, again, adopted a more integral approach, the way people have learn to cooperate and be resourceful. That that puts us in a different space. And this movement, this great mystery that's happening. If you could concisely, because we only have like a minute left before we go to our break, what is the light that you're seeing? What's the sliver of hope, or maybe it's a big fat beam of light that is lighting our way to the future? What is it that you see that goes, yes, this is worth doing, it's worth pushing through this difficulty?
Well, there are a bunch of different ones. Maybe we'll have to go back after the break. But the first thing is, the future is emergent. We cannot know what the future is. The second is that technological progress is exponential. In addition to the miraculous powers that are already predicted, there may be even more fundamental breakthroughs with far-reaching consequences. It's also the case that disasters function as wake-up calls, and they open up windows of opportunity for more fundamental systems redesign. It's also true that the whole history of evolution, as you wrote about in Spontaneous Evolution, is a history of miracle after miracle after miracle. And I think that principle operates in cultural evolution just as solidly as it does in biological evolution. So, for sure, we don't know enough to be pessimistic, especially when pessimism can function as a self-fulfilling prophecy. So there are all kinds of very intelligent reasons for having more than just a sense of a sliver of hope.
Well, that's good. We're going to go much deeper into that, and I think you're absolutely right. I love the idea that, really the future truly is unpredictable, and if you allow yourself to fall into a negative narrative, it will be created. We're back with Terry Patton after this break.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Imagine, it is the year 2039. A single corporation controls most of the world through genetic modification, food, and drugs. A senior geneticist's lover dies, launching him on a quest to take down the psychopathic CEO and the handful of elite families that control the corporation. The feature film Corporate Prey, based on the novel of the same name, points us toward a dystopian future where we seem to be headed. Huge corporations do largely control our farms and our pharma. And wealthy elites seem to be operating to the detriment of most humans. Can we reverse course? Can prophecy lead to prevention? Can a movie awaken enough of us in time? To find out more and how you can help bring this enlightening film to light, go to CorporatePrey.com. Corporate Prey. That's P-R-E-Y.
In the wake of a disaster, what one thing can you send that will help people the most? A blanket. A tent, a sandbag, a doctor. Actually, if you send a monetary donation, you send all these things. Even a small donation can make a big impact and can quickly become exactly what people affected by disaster need most.
In the wake of a hurricane, your monetary donation can make a huge difference to those in need. To donate, visit supporthurricanerelief.org. That's supporthurricanerelief.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hello, Steve Behrman back with WikiPolitiki and our guest, Terry Patton. He's the author of a new book called The New Republic of the Heart that takes a really very, very clear and sober look at where we are as a species, the crises, and the evolutionary opportunity. Before the break, we were talking about this evolutionary opportunity. Say more about that, and then what you see as some of the pathways that are opening up for us to actually make this shift.
Well, you know, natural evolution takes place often by crisis. If we look at the biological record, it's often viewed as a series of stable states punctuated by periods of rapid change. And so we hit the jackpot. We're living in the time of the most rapid, intense change ever. And in our lifetime, things are going to be happening that are going to affect the whole future of life on Earth, not just for our species, but for pretty much all species, or at least most of them. And something about that was part of what attracted us here. Our souls, somehow, in some unknowable way, must have assented to being here now. So we were built for this trip. The people who are adequate to deal with this crisis must be us. And, you know, take a mugshot of yourself just the way you are. These are the people who were selected for this mission, like it or not. And therefore, it ennobles us. If we can recognize this, wow, we got born into an adventure. You know, and it's guaranteed no matter what happens, we're going to die at the end, you know. No matter what happens, we're going to have some successes and joys. And no matter what happens, there are going to be some heartbreaking losses. So in some sense, there's a shift of perspective in which all of the very, very discouraging and even terrifying kind of potentials that can immobilize people can be recontextualized, and we can let them function. I think of this whole thing as a gigantic Shaktipat, a Kundalini initiation, a shot of necessity that's running through the nervous system of the collective and requiring all of us to come into a whole new octave, a higher frequency of running energy and consciousness. And I think it's an exciting possibility, and I'm up for it. You know, I feel that we can actually be shocked by this into a tremendously vulnerable, deep, and present contact with one another. It can actually create a different quality of friendship and community, too.
You know, there's something that in our, you know, again, we have, I love the idea of the reincarnational idea, because it gives us the sense of continuity and being part of something that's whole. And, you know, we've had this experience in this lifetime, that and that. And it enriches our souls over long periods of time, to be able to have all of these other things, you know. And at the same time, we are so tied into this culture, we so imagine that we are that this is what it is, that our culture, our life, this is the world, this is reality. And, you know, even in our news and our fake news and that's real and real news that's fake, we're having, it's kind of like the matrix is being busted. And it's the matrix of our secular humanist belief system, and also the matrix of these fundamentalist religions that have, that have a rather limited view of our cosmology. How, because really this is a species-wide awakening. In the midst of this species-wide awakening, how do we deal with all of these hugely divergent worldviews, like people living in parallel universes?
Well, it's a huge problem right now, and it's interesting. It partly has to do with identity and cultural identity. I mean, the big divide between the left and the right in the United States, between the rural heartland Republicans and the urban coastal Democrats, is potentially, you know, a pathological breakdown that you know is very, very serious. But there are splits between the worldviews on the left that are much more complex. You know, the right is all pretty much governed by a traditional to modern orientation that allows for discipline. That's why the right can kind of march in lockstep pretty well and have the same talking points and reach a pretty strong unanimity. Whereas on the left, you've got modern, postmodern, and post-postmodern worldviews. You've got biases toward interior causation and exterior causation. That is, what's happening is just the responsibility of the individual versus it's created by social and structural causes. You've got a whole lot of diversity. You've got activists and spiritual practitioners. You've got a whole menagerie here on the left. So I think that there's a lot of work we can do here in deepening our conversations with one another across divides, even on the left. I think our ability to come into a different kind of discourse on the left is the precondition for us to be effective in reconciling with our conservative cousins and neighbors and friends. Focus on tackling the reknitting of the social fabric in our country actually requires a lot more knowing that we don't know, recognizing that our own perspectives, however true our perspective might be in some ways, it's also partial. It's not 100%. And that's called epistemic humility. Epistemic is kind of a $6 word. But it basically means knowing that whatever you don't know 100%. You think you know. And that humility is the beginning point for the kind of humility that can enable people to actually listen and learn in their discourse with each other. We got to do that. It's a big, big issue right now.
It is. And, after the election, there was that wonderful 90-something page article that Ken Wilber wrote that really talked about the failure of the postmodern approach. And I don't know how many of our listeners are familiar with that, but maybe you can lay that out a little bit, because I think it's very, very significant why what Ken Wilber would call the green meme came up against its own limitations.
Well, you know, Ken's critique largely it derives from an understanding of worldviews as evolving culturally, that there was a traditional worldview that governed pretty much everybody in the world for several thousand years, where the authority for truth is in places like the Bible or the king or the Pope or Aristotle. It was appeals to authority. Then we have a modern worldview where you know truth by measuring it and doing science or competing in a marketplace. It's kind of merit-based. You got a postmodern worldview that begins to realize that, gosh, dying with the most toys isn't really winning. And how do we feel? And what are the hidden agendas that are involved? And so, at the postmodern worldview, we care a whole lot more for our feelings and our inner lives. We also care more for the environment and for other creatures and other people who've been marginalized. And then there's a post-postmodern worldview or an integral worldview that's just coming into being now that can see a lot of this. Those different worldviews are in play in culture. And the postmodern worldview, one of the big things that it recognized early on is that where you stand determines what you see. The language you speak determines the questions you can ask. And that therefore the claim for objective truth that the naive positivistic modernist scientists were making just wasn't, didn't hold water, wasn't legitimate. Unfortunately, this recognition that truth is to some degree constructed can be taken to an extreme and become a kind of radical relativism. Everybody's entitled to their own truth. And the way that very, very sophisticated philosophical idea has sifted down into culture has gotten us to this post-truth environment in which many, many, many people believe all kinds of wacky stuff, all kinds of, there are some conspiracies, but there are many more conspiracy theories than there are real conspiracies to pay attention to, and yet there's very little ability to discern among all those things in the popular mind. And so you've got all kinds of people believing in InfoWars, fake news, to the point that the term fake news is used most often today by Donald Trump in order to delegitimize real journalism. That's how distorted things are. We live right now in a Brave New World newspeak environment, and the reason that's been able to happen is because this relativization of truth. We live in a post-truth world, and that is a huge problem. On the other hand, though, healthy postmodern values, particularly environmental values and attention to our interiors, which make a whole new level of friendship and community and even conversation possible, are really crucial to the way forward. So I think it's important to understand that. I think it's also maybe worth talking a little bit about what would be a healthier kind of politics. You know, I mean, this postmodern contribution to the confusions right now. I mean, yes, it should be decried. On the other hand, we don't want to go back to a merely conformist traditional orientation or a rigidly modern one. We're in a really interesting moment right now where the future of even journalism, of an open internet, of, you know, we're in a dangerous time. And anger and polarization aren't the way to be effective, but we've got to recognize there's a traitor, a very, very effective traitor against our country, in charge of our country. There's a criminal in charge of our country. Our president is, you know, a very, very dangerous factor. And can our Constitution and our institutions resist that? Well, we don't know, but it's definitely going to require citizens who are engaged. Democracy only works when there's an engaged citizenry. So what's our part? What does our growth and our consciousness imply in the midst of that situation? Well, it certainly, to me, it implies really deep engagement in the 2018 election cycle in a way that we haven't before. Most of us are comfortable and we don't necessarily like political involvement, but I think we got to begin regarding some in-the-system engagement that will affect the outcome of the election as a tithe to our time that we're all going to have to begin to be making, because we can't leave it to somebody else to hold the house together. The house, the roof's half off, gang. We have a job to do.
That is an accurate assessment, you know. And again, the Republican Party, in my view, has turned into a dangerous cult in that they have not spoken out against what is obvious to the rest of us, what you just stated about our fearless leader. Should be no. I mean, anyone in the world can see, as Jonah Goldberg, a conservative commentator, said, "Character is destiny." About Donald Trump, and he wasn't talking about good character. So, we have, because of the fake news, because of InfoWars, and because of real conspiracies being polluted by disinformation, intended to lead people down the wrong pathways, fighting against the wrong enemies. You know, we have this this vast confusion. Now, in your book, you talked about working through the system, working around the system, and working outside the system. And then you also talked about transpartisan politics and integral politics. So, you mentioned some integral projects that were very heartening in terms of getting people to actually work together beyond these perceived ideological divides. Can you say something about those kind of integral political projects that have worked?
Yeah, well, let me say something first about what integral is. Integral is another word for that stage beyond postmodernism, and it's a more complex kind of thinking. It moves from, like, thinking in an either-or binary way to both-and thinking that manages polarities, that realizes that there are a lot of polarities that are not good-bad polarities. They're like breathing in and breathing out. You need both sides of those polarities. And, in fact, holding the paradoxes between contradictions, between personal individual interest and the group, or between process and the parts. All those things have their truth. It's a recognition that whatever perspective you're looking at sees something real, but it also misses something. Even the eagle eye view from way up in the sky that can see a full range of the territory can't get down close and smell things or see what's happening under the trees. So that humility allows us to have more insight into the factors that structure perspective. That's what Ken Wilber's philosophy, he's the kind of most prominent integral philosopher. He makes these five distinctions of quadrants, levels, lines, states, and types. And those five distinctions illuminate a whole bunch of deep things that make it such that many conversations don't intersect. They're contained by a certain perspective, and they're not intersecting with this other conversation that makes a whole different set of presumptions and takes place in an entirely different perspective. It also notes that these structures of mind evolve, like I was talking, traditional, modern, postmodern, and so forth, and there's a new higher level of complexity or an ability to include and tolerate complexity and paradox at each new level. So that's why most integral political initiatives are transpartisan. There's an integral think tank called the Institute for Cultural Evolution that tries to imagine a future left and a future right and what they would be like. And there are integral political commentators like Jeff Salzman or Rob Smith who take a disposition that tries to rise above the simple polarities, where they can acknowledge the value of entrepreneurship even while acknowledging the limits of markets and capitalism, where they can acknowledge the potentially stifling inefficiency of government mandates and regulation, even while recognizing the necessity of some market regulation. In our current circumstance, it drops the absolutisms that libertarians or that socialists would otherwise put forward. And one of the best embodiments, a simple project, was my friend Stephen Martineau near Nelson, British Columbia in the Slocan Valley. There was a kind of a war going on between a variety of different interests, some of them more environmental, some of them more pro-forestry. There was a huge forest, there was a big forestry company, there were a lot of jobs on the line, there were also pristine watersheds. And what he ended up doing was holding a whole series of community meetings and gradually getting the group to agree that everybody was going to have to come into some level of agreement if they were going to have a solution.
Terry, I'm going to interrupt you because we're about to take a break in about 2 seconds. We'll come back and talk more about this worthwhile integral project when we return from this break with Terry Patton.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network. Presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
I rescued Toast from a shelter in 2011. I love Toast because she's a lazy diva. Toast does whatever she wants, obviously. She's sleeping right now. She's so loving. She's so comforting. When I walked into the shelter, I knew right then that she was special.
Toast, Instagram star and shelter pet. Amazing adoption stories start in shelters. Start yours today. Visit theshelterpetproject.org to find a pet near you. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
We're back. Wiki Politiki. We're talking with Terry Patton about his new book, The New Republic of the Heart. And Terry is right in the middle of telling us about a project where many different sides that disagreed were brought together to work together. So why don't we just pick that up and run with it?
Yeah. Well, this Integral Forestry Trust, Slocan Integral Forestry Trust in British Columbia, what happened was that after reaching out to a few people, having a series of community meetings, and then a series of small meetings between key leaders, they ended up agreeing that, you know, all the residents held different perspectives that were guided by a whole mix of social, economic, scientific, spiritual, psychological, cultural, political, historical, institutional lenses. It was a big mix. And by acknowledging that everybody else had a perspective and that all those perspectives had something to contribute, those fundamental agreements, they were able to get the whole community to sign on to a single approach. And he had to let go. He was more of an environmentalist, but what he realized, you know, if the aim is to reduce wood consumption and construction by 70%, it's better to achieve 20% than hold out for 70% and get nothing, especially if there are means for the 20% to become 30 and then 40. You know, this kind of willingness to compromise was the core of it, but that built upon actual communication and giving people with different worldviews the experience of being heard. And so that's a beautiful example, because it began just as a series of conversations, and it's turned into a cooperative that now has, you know, 12 to 15 employees, over $1 million in revenue, and it manages 35,000 acres, and they're able to do things like have a replanting program that takes into account what's happening with global warming, such that the replanting is taking into account greater variation and in the species mix is able to evolve in ways that otherwise would have created a whole lot of die-off. So there's a wisdom being brought in that project that is representative. I identify four integral or evolutionary projects that use this multi-perspectival, multi-level kind of thinking to actually create tangible changes in particular local situations. And I include them not because any one of them can be scaled to solve the huge problems. I mean, one of the issues that I notice people feel is that, my God, this array of jams that we're in this whole series of jams, and it's going to take whole system change to turn this whole thing around. And no matter how successful our projects are, they're not engineering that, and so there's this tendency to get overwhelmed and depressed. But letting ourselves recognize that we're living in that kind of a critical time, and then directing our attention to projects like this one that actually make a tangible difference, it's the beginning of something new, and that's what I'm calling a new republic of the heart. The end of the book has about 30 pages of resources where I'm listing literally dozens and dozens of worthwhile projects, and frankly, there are even more that I didn't know about or didn't know to list that could have been listed. There is actually a transformation happening already. And you know, even if we go down attempting to be the change that could have turned this around, That's the way I want to go down. You know, we don't have to know the future to know that doing the thing that would have transformed it and enabled us to have long-term thriving into the future, you know, that's still the way that we would want to write our book in the book of life, write our name, rather, in the book of life, as the Kabbalists would put it, and be present, even under the worst of circumstances. So there's a kind of wild, multidimensional, awakened, but humble sense of wonder and possibility that have come upon me after contemplating our larger predicament deeply over a period of several years. And I hope that some of that will rub off on folks. Maybe some of you will be moved to read this book. I think it takes us on a deeper integrative journey that can help you see the inner work, that can help you to show up in the midst of this in a way that isn't superficial or asleep or numb or depressed or aloof or strategizing. Like, there's a way that this is so serious that we've got to find our way to a kind of sweetness where that which is best in our heart minds actually comes forward and meets. I think it's the basis for a new kind of relationship and a kind of tenderness that I hope will become actually, you know, a love that is even more powerful than anger, more authoritative than anger. Anger is the energy to change that which needs to be changed, and love is even more energy than that.
You know, one of the things that I was that I noticed in terms of really looking at this entire issue, I guess it's been like a year or 2 years, you and Peter Russell, I believe, engaged in a dialogue, because so many people, you can't talk about us going down. It's not good, that it's not going to work and so on. And in that dialogue, you and Peter Russell addressed very tenderly and very clearly the prospect that it's just as possible that we're on a hospice mission than as we are in a midwife mission. And there's something about speaking that. It's kind of like the near-death experience that makes us more alive, in acknowledging that that deep truth. It's a sigh of relief. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's how I feel it too, Steve. I mean, for me, it has been, and I think for others, it will be too. You know, kind of a searing, you know, very painful thing to think about the possibility that, you know, human civilization may be caught in something like a death spiral, and we may not be able to turn it around. But you know, at the end of his life, James Hillman, the great Jungian psychotherapist, was evaluating his life. He was already in his 80s; he didn't have much longer to live. And he said, you know, my life work is my character, and the way that I go through this process of losing faculties, losing friends, losing loved ones, and then finally losing my own life is going to express my character even more fully. I'm going to put a finish on that work. If we compare it to a piece of fine woodworking, it would be the time that I use the fine grit sandpaper and rub in the oil and buff it to a sheen. And that may be the circumstance for the human species. If it is, then the love, the intelligence, the generosity, the courage, the depth of soul that we bring to that process of the unraveling will matter. It will matter that the human experiment ended with something beautiful in play. These crises tend to bring out what's best and what's worst in us, and it therefore really does come down to some degree to a matter of personal practice. But it's not just personal, it's relational. It's how we practice together. And it's communities of practitioners that are going to make the difference. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh so famously said the next Buddha may be a Sangha, that is a community of rather than an individual. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the changes ahead are going to have to be reinforced not by some charismatic individual, but by groups of people who are in conversation in a authentic and tender and real enough way that our whole way of being together can light the way for others. And I'm hoping to participate as you know, just as a citizen of such a new republic of the heart. That's a noble aspiration. And yet we arrive at those doors like you would arrive at a recovery center, like addicts. You know, like all of us are being the thing that's killing the earth. And yet all of us arrive in our intention to be what's true, like, you know, humbly, like a whole bunch of people are arriving at the recovery center and we realize, oh, there's no therapists, there's no protocols. Us addicts are going to have to create the protocols and go through this process of our own transformation together. And I think that this is going to dawn as a broader recognition among intelligent, deep people more and more, and that a kind of tenderness and connectedness among us is going to begin actually transforming spiritual culture. You know, very often communities of practice, oh, they end up getting cultic and ingrown, and they have their own internal politics, and they're only a little bit better than the general society sometimes. And the remaking of our spiritual fellowships into something that genuinely has a greater form of purity, where we really do get past the ego games and we really do find our way to be loved together and to work together in a way that is love more broadly. That's the game now. That's what's really important. That's what's really happening, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, I think that's exactly right, that we don't have any control over the end, how the game ends. However, we can choose which game we play. And right now, we're emerging from this trance of the individual, which was important for our evolution, essential for our evolution. And, you know, because we're in this process of learning. It never ends. We just keep going and going. This planet, some other planet, et cetera, et cetera. And as you were describing, those of us who chose to be here at this point and be part of this awakening or upwising or whatever we want to call it, it really is about the practice. And what I love about your book is that it really, really weaves together individual practice, communal practice, and then how this relates to the way we wake up every day and address our world. And, you know, whether you're being born or whether you're dying, love is a helpful thing to have. We're getting close to the end of our conversation, hard to believe. One of the phrases that you used, radical integral ecology. So maybe that would be something to use to wrap this up, because we're going to be pointing people in the direction of what might possibly work as a way of being during these times. And so in the next 3 minutes, or whatever we have left, what can you say about that, Terry?
Well, I would say that I use this phrase, radical integral ecology, to indicate a synthesis of deep ecology and integral philosophy and practice. Because it's necessary that the profundity of recognizing that there is no health for humans except in the context of a healthy living earth. And that's the understanding of deep ecology. But integral philosophy understands that all of us are speaking out of different perspectives, and that those perspectives tend to be non-intersecting, and an appreciation for how they can evolve and the distinctions among those perspectives is absolutely necessary too. So that results in an orientation that's humble and I use this phrase, post-ironic. That is, instead of like speaking truth to power, it's able to actually recognize the responsibility of real human adults to acquire and wisely use power and not just speak truth to it. And it's also integrally spiritual, in that it will be awakened in the sense of the high non-dual awareness dharmas, but also deeply spiritual, like earth-based native cultures really in reverent contact with the non-human forms of life, which are a source of our health and wisdom. So it's win-win-win, like not just me and you, but also the whole. And these solutions are really out-of-the-box solutions that are not out of the frame of a kind of conventional dualistic thinking. And so this book, A New Republic of the Heart, brings those together. And I really hope people will, you can just put New Republic of the Heart in your browser or my name in your browser, and you'll find your way to a page where you can download a free excerpt from the book and or as a PDF or an MP3 of me reading it. And I hope you'll go a little deeper. I do think this can be a springboard for you becoming the change, really being the change that you want to see in the world in a way that is profoundly deeper. You know, we're evolving fast, and each step we take forward in that evolution may be critical even to the future of life on this planet.
Wow. Well, that's where we have to end this conversation for now. Terry Patton, and it's a very worthwhile book, The New Republic of the Heart, that sets a new standard for what we humans are up to. Thank you so much, Terry Patton, for being with us this week on Wiki Politiki. Steve Fairman, we'll talk with you next week.